Good morning to all. I'd like to start by thanking Lorenzo and Tommaso and all the other organizers for inviting me to this wonderful meeting. The title is somewhat self-evident, and I will talk about different modes of feedback that we've been considering recently in our lab. I'm going to change a little bit the format of this talk. Rather than going deeply into all the hardware and nitty-gritty details of our system, I wanted to give you more of an overview of what are the technologies and experiments that we can do now with these particular qubits, in hopes that that will spark some good discussions with our theory colleagues here. So I'd like to thank our current theoretical collaborators listed here. So I call this slide the challenge of gregarious qubits, right? So John gave us a good introduction this morning to superconducting qubits, and one of the real advantages is that you can wire them up, and you can wire a lot of them up, and that's because they like to talk to their environment. The challenge is they like to talk to everything in the environment. So in fact, it becomes rather challenging to make sure they only talk to the degrees of freedom you want them to talk to. So in terms of noise sources, there's of course the vacuum, right? And if this were our only noise source, we'd be in really good shape, because we know in fact how to engineer around vacuum fluctuations. But in reality, there are things that I affectionately call defects, because some of them we know what they are, others we have no clue what they are. But in reality, they exist both in the environment and also close to our qubits. So that's really the problem at hand, is how to efficiently maintain coherence in such an environment. One of the tricks that we can use is to use a resonant cavity. And in reality, anything which limits the frequencies over which our qubit communicates to the environment is a useful tool. The challenge is, with these defects, you can imagine and envision that there's information flowing out of the qubit. Okay? The challenge is we don't really have access to this information in this particular picture, but nevertheless, we do pay the price for it. We do have the back action associated with this information extraction. And if you do nothing in terms of control, the state of the art these days is of order 10 to 100 microseconds for lifetimes. So this is what we've done by good engineering and trying to reduce those little black spots in the environment. So this has brought us now to a stage where we can actually consider circuits to actively combat the remaining decoherence. And I'm going to tell you about what I've now collected together here as engineered dissipation. And in fact, there are three ways that I'm going to talk about that we have tried to, in fact, enhance the coherence in these systems, okay, by modifying the dissipation seen by the qubit. The first experiment is called quantum bath engineering, okay, and it's, in fact, akin to laser cooling. The second one is where we, in fact, squeeze the vacuum fluctuations themselves, okay, to suppress radiative decay of the atoms. And the third one is measurement-based feedback. These two require quantum-limited parametric amplifiers. So why did I pick these particular experiments? In reality, what we would like to do later on down the road is to generate remote entanglement between objects and stabilize them. So these are some very basic fundamental building blocks of how we can cool our system to a desired state, how we can squeeze the vacuum fluctuations where we want to squeeze them to suppress decay, and where, in fact, we can use measurement-based feedback as well to stabilize the system. So that's the program. So I hope to finish in 28 minutes. So the first one, just to give you sort of a cartoon picture of these three experiments, the first one is very similar to laser cooling. And in fact, there was a very nice proposal by Peter Zoller in 96 and other works that show that if you can tailor the dissipation, tailor the environment or spectrum of fluctuations that your qubit sees, you don't have to cool to an uninteresting state like the ground state. You could cool, in fact, to some more complicated quantum state. And in this particular example, we simply use microwave pulses in tandem with these vacuum fluctuations to cool to a superposition state. Okay. So in fact, we can not only cool to the 0 plus 1 state, we can cool to actually any state on the Bloch sphere using this particular algorithm. Okay. The second experiment of quantum bath engineering revolves around squeezing the fluctuations. So in fact, here we take the usual Gaussian vacuum and feed that into our parametric amplifier to produce squeeze vacuum. And then we study what is, in fact, the decay rate of our qubit in the presence of this squeezed vacuum. And we can rotate how our squeezed vacuum interacts with the qubit. Okay, and there's been a number of proposals and experiments with squeezing in the past. Okay. And finally, this is my cartoon for measurement-based feedback. This takes a slightly different approach. And the idea is we keep the dissipation, but we add another source of dissipation, which is extremely strong, which is us. right, in the form of this particular observer. So we have big blue and red arrows, but we are able to do something with the information we extract from the system. In particular, we're able to close this little green loop here, shown as the control loop. Okay. So in this particular experiment, we've been able to stabilize Rabi oscillations by feeding back directly to the system. So that's the plan. So first, I would like to thank Frank and other experimental theory colleagues for perfectly describing all the hardware and superconducting qubits, and also showing fridges and so on and so forth, so I can cut that discussion very short. The qubit for us is just an LC oscillator, so it has a fancy name called the transmon. In reality, most superconducting qubits are simply LC oscillators, where the inductive part is nonlinear, shown here. So in fact, I have now the quantized levels in a cosine potential. Okay. This is a picture of the device. These are the aluminum-aluminum oxide tunnel junctions that go in there in this particular device. And then how do you read it out? Well, we are very much influenced by atomic physics. So we consider the case of an atom in a cavity with the James-Cummings interaction. And to show that I'm a bona fide scientist, I've written down the Hamiltonian here. As experimentalists, sometimes we feel we need to write down equations. So here's the James-Cummings Hamiltonian. In the dispersive regime, you can imagine that the cavity transmission is simply pulled by the state of the qubit. Okay, so this is our meter. And you can realize this particular architecture any way you like. Here's a picture in more circuit-based format, where everything is on chip and planar, so on and so forth. Similar to what John was showing this morning with integrated circuits, but still with the cavity. Or you can actually do a real analog of microwave QED, where you have a little qubit with big ears to give you a really big dipole and put it in a physical cavity. These particular implementations are what I want to talk about in this talk, because typically the lifetimes are very long, and that's handy for carrying out these feedback experiments. Later on, of course, any vehicle is perfectly acceptable. All right, so experiment number one, how do we stabilize a superposition? Okay. So in fact, the environment that my qubit sees, I want to tailor it by actually taking a driven cavity. Right? So the starting point is if I take a cavity with frequency omega c, I can imagine driving the cavity at some other frequency omega d, and these two can be detuned by capital delta here. So there's this very nice expression, this paper by Ashish Clerk, which writes down the spectral density of photon number fluctuations in the cavity. And it has this particular expression shown here. And in the denominator, there's an omega plus delta c term squared here. And this gives you a spectrum of fluctuations which looks like this. Okay? And the red and the blue corresponds to whether you have positive detuning or negative detuning in your drive. Okay? So in particular, if delta is positive, then you have the red case. So the noise, in fact, peaks at negative frequencies. And what that means is that your cavity, okay, can in fact emit, and it will heat any object that's in the cavity. If you are in the opposite regime of negative detuning, the noise peaks at positive frequencies, so the cavity can absorb and in fact cool an object inside of it. So the idea is very simple. You have detuning between these two objects. You put a quantum object inside, it can either absorb or emit a photon at that detuning. And we're going to use this to our advantage to, in fact, cool a superconducting qubit. And the system is driven as follows. I imagine the two levels of my transmon qubit, shown here as ground and excited states. And I drive Rabi oscillations on resonance. Okay? So I have a continuous drive. And in the rotating frame, my eigenstates now are plus and minus eigenstates. Right? These are the symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of ground and excited states. The new energy level splitting is capital omega. So for a transmon qubit, we're typically limited a little bit to how fast we can drive these oscillations, given the unhermeticity of the qubit. Typical parameter in this experiment is about 10 megahertz. Okay. At 10 megahertz, okay, this particular system will be in a thermal state, no matter how cool you cool it in your dilution refrigerator. Okay. So in reality, we will have an equal combination of plus and minus states. So the goal is, can I cool, let's say, to the plus state, shown as this blue dot here, can I autonomously cool the system to 0 plus 1 and keep it there? Okay. So here's where this cavity cooling comes in. I apply another drive at omega d, okay, and in fact, it's red detuned from the cavity. So this process, which is the anti-Stokes process, right, making linkage to photon language, this anti-Stokes process is in fact enhanced, and the cavity is going to go ahead and absorb a photon from the qubit and cool it very efficiently down to the plus state. So we cool to a thermal state, from a thermal state to this plus state. Does it really work? How do I check it? So here's the experiment we did. This is the first benchmarking that we did. We did the usual Ramsey measurement, right? 2 pi over 2 pulses separated out by a variable decay, no cooling. And what you can see here is this is the average population of the ground state. It oscillates as it should, and it decays of order on a time of order 5 microseconds. Okay, so that's T2 star for this qubit. One of the things that you'll notice is that we had very poor contrast. Right? We had only 40% contrast in those oscillations. And that really wasn't due to the measurement being bad of the qubit. This particular qubit was extremely hot. It had 20% population in the excited state for various reasons. So we thought it's a great qubit to try to cool. Right? Maybe not a great qubit to advertise, but it's a great qubit to try to cool with this method. So we, in fact, turned on this cooling pulse at the qubit frequency. And here's the result that you have now. This experiment should be explained a little bit. I first parked the qubit on this 0 plus 1 state on the equator of the Bloch sphere. And then I turn on this cooling pulse, and I leave it on for some period of time. So in reality, I start from the North Pole, I park it there, and I just leave it there. And then I put another pi over 2 pulse after some later time to see if I've actually maintained this state there. So you can see, again, I get these Ramsey-like oscillations. It's not exactly Ramsey, because in fact, I'm simply parking the state, which is there. And you can see very rapidly I recover, in fact, the contrast. So I am able to cool more efficiently to this particular state. Moreover, I can really park it there for as long as I want. Right? So this is now in milliseconds. So we can really maintain the state by keeping the system continuously cooling to this particular ground state. So this is an example of laser cooling of a dress state, if you like, in this particular case. Okay. So again, to throw a few more equations, one can understand this by Redfield theory, and you can write down the rates to go to these plus and minus states by looking at the spectral density of fluctuations. And if you consider the case that the detuning in your cavity is the Rabi frequency, right, this is what you're doing when you apply the Rabi frequency, you get a very nice expression for gamma minus and gamma plus. And in reality, you simply have to choose n bar to be a very efficient value to have this cooling. And the idea is that we can actually do that and map out this particular theory very precisely for different values of n bar. So you can see here, if I apply no photons to cool the qubit, then I really don't have a lot of coherence in the x. In fact, I have zero. As I apply more photons, I build up coherence along the equator. And this is me actually populating this 0 plus 1 state. And as you can see, nothing happens to the sigma z, as it should. So it stays on the equator, and it cools efficiently there. So now, finally, we can tell our atomic physics colleagues we have also done a cooling experiment. Our experiment is cooling a dress state to 150 microkelvin in this particular case. Okay. And to finish up this particular topic, you're not restricted to the equator. You can imagine driving the system with a Rabi frequency, which is detuned from that of your qubit. And that will tilt you to a particular latitude on the Bloch sphere. Now, the efficiency goes down. This process is resonant on the equator. It's most efficient there. But nevertheless, you can still cool to places off the equator. And if you go to the poles, then you realize in atomic physics this sideband Raman cooling. So everything fits together in this particular experiment. So that's an example of autonomous feedback, if you like, or coherent feedback, where we're simply just letting the system cool to a desired state. Number two, okay, what can we do with the vacuum? Right? After all, the vacuum is also a source of decoherence. Can we squeeze it? So this experiment is envisioned as follows. I have my transmon qubit. It's placed inside a cavity. Now I have a parametric amplifier which generates squeezing. There have been numerous beautiful examples of this in the past. But in fact, what we're trying to look at here is not a light-on-light interaction, but rather a light-on-matter interaction. So this is not trying to use squeeze light to interfere with itself for greater stability or greater sensitivity. I'm actually trying to produce squeeze fluctuations and see that can I detect them in a real physical system. Okay. So in this particular case, I have to say a few words about the transmon qubit. The case of an atom directly coupled to squeeze vacuum was treated by Gardner and others. It's very well known for many, many years. This is, in fact, an atom in a cavity. And we operate the qubit here in the polariton regime. Right? And what I mean by that is this is very close to resonance. So this is one quantum object. Right? So this is actually not the dispersive regime of the Jaynes-Cummings Hamiltonian. This is the resonant regime. Right? So in reality, the qubit and cavity behave as one quantum object, and that quantum object is coupled to squeeze backing. Okay? The control that we have in this experiment is we can produce squeeze fluctuations, say, around the I quadrature. We can actually rotate the qubit state, right, anywhere on the Bloch sphere, so we can couple either to the squeeze part of the fluctuations or the amplified part of the fluctuations. So we can rotate the relative angle between the squeezing and the qubit. So I have to tell you, first of all, what is our implementation of this amplifier. It's a little bit different than these amplifiers. It's actually quite convenient because it is exactly the same circuit as the qubit, right? It is an LC circuit once more. The only thing which is different is that L and C are radically different. The impedance of this LC circuit is extremely low. The barrier is very high, so there are many, many levels. It's not quantized at any temperature that we work at. It's simply a pendulum. Right? It's a damp-driven pendulum. And if you take this system and you plot the pump frequency here and the power, just as the pendulum should do, there's a decrease in the resonant frequency. In fact, there's a bifurcation at this particular green point shown here. If you operate below that bifurcation point, it works as a very good parametric amplifier. Okay. This is a physical picture of what this device looks like. Okay. So how do we parameterize the squeezing? The nomenclature that I want to use here is this usual squeezing moments nomenclature, where there's N and M. And N describes the correlator, this delta correlator, between A dagger and A. And M describes the correlator between A with itself. For squeeze states, N is less than M. For classical states, N is greater than M. And for Gaussian vacuum, N is equal to M. And this is the usual nomenclature for squeezing. If you take this N and M formalism, Gardner-Bloch equations, which are shown here, Gardner in his paper, showed what should be the relaxation rate, right, of the various components of a spin along x, y, and z in the presence of this squeezing. So in fact, if you plug in N equals M equals 0, which is the usual Gaussian relaxation, you get the canonical prediction that T2 is 2T1 in the absence of dephasing. Okay, so that's the familiar result that we have. We actually want to violate this in certain directions. We want to see if the decay in Y, for example, is the decay is different than the decay in X. Okay, and in fact, does this vary along with the phase, okay, of between the squeezing and the qubit? That's the experiment at hand. Okay, so we affectionately call these the zebra plots. Okay, and you can see why. So this first zebra plot shows the usual Ramsey experiment. Two pi over two pulses separated by a certain time. But the only thing I vary along this horizontal axis here is the phase of my pi over two pulse. So I do a Ramsey measurement. I start from the North Pole. I come down to the equator. But I have a choice whether I point along x, along y, or any other angle when I start my Ramsey experiment. So in a usual Ramsey experiment, it does not matter where you start. It just changes the start phase of the oscillations. So if I take a line cut here at pi, that's simply showing me a Ramsey modulation which starts with the state going down. If I start at 0, it's out of phase, so on and so forth. So and that phase shift is reflected on the angle here of these fluctuations. Okay. You still have oscillatory behavior. The time constant does not change irrespective of the start phase of your Ramsey oscillation. However, if you now insert squeezed vacuum inside, there is a remarkable difference of whether the oscillations start with the block vector along the x or y directions. So you can see when it's pointing along x, the decay is in fact suppressed. And the oscillations live quite a long time. If you're along the y-axis, the decay is significantly faster. Right? And that's shown here clearly by these alternating patterns here of the Ramsey fringes. So in reality, if I change the angle of my Ramsey and my squeezed vacuum, I change the decay rate. So I'm feeling the effect of squeezed vacuum. Okay. So you can start really see this. If you start the state here, shown at I, and let it relax to F, and what we can do is a tomography in the X, Y, Y, Z, and X, Z planes, shown here. If you start from I, you can see if these points are, in fact, equally spaced in the time that they were taken, the relaxation rate between X and Y is extremely different. So you see, for example, in Y, all those points are bunched together. In X, the relaxation is quite rapid. Right? So in that particular trajectory here, maps out very well with the degree of squeezing that we have in the system. Moreover, we have now, in fact, used the qubit to do a different experiment in quantum optics now. We are using the qubit to reconstruct the Wigner function of an itinerant squeeze state. So the qubit, in fact, is a very useful tool in this particular experiment for doing quantum optics. Okay. And in fact, you can plot the rates here as a function of Tx, as a function of the squeezing, n, and you can see x, in fact, is enhanced, y is decreased. You can also do the following experiment, which is to change the detuning so that the squeezing is actually rotating relative to the qubit. For optimal squeezing, we can actually violate this 2T1 bound. Okay, so in reality, T2 is not 2T1 in this case, because in fact we have suppressed the decay along that axis. Okay. In this plot, we show you basically that if you had a classical state, you would be in this particular region here. If it was perfectly quantum, you'd be on that dashed line. We're a factor of 2 off from this canonical quantum prediction, reflecting the efficiency of squeezing in our experiment. So the final topic is, now I have 2 of these things in hand, can I actually take the information out and do real-time feedback? In this particular experiment, what we're going to do is try to stabilize an oscillation. We're going to set up Rabi oscillation in the system and make weak measurements of the system and feedback upon it. So there are 2 regimes to actually do this kind of experiment. If you start off with a superposition state, 50-50 between 0 and 1, if one realizes a strong QND measurement, for example, with this meter from the Niels Bohr company, you will either get 0 or 1, and the uncertainty is smaller than the separation of 0 and 1, so there's no ambiguity between what is 0 and what is 1. So you get maximum information at the cost, of course, of pushing the system fully to 0 or 1. And you can still use that for a regime of feedback, which is very nicely illustrated in this recent paper by the ENS group. And Philippe is also here, so he has a poster if you're interested in this topic. We're going to look at a different modality where the separation of the histograms is small, so we only get partial information in a given measurement. And what that does is it tips the block vector up. It does not completely project it to 0 or 1 and gives us now some time to go ahead and correct back and put it into a superposition state. Okay. So how does one realize weak measurements in cavity QED? This is actually quite easy. If you put no photons into the cavity, you learn very little about the qubit. Okay. And in fact, as you put more and more photons into the qubit, you separate out the position of the histograms corresponding to 0 and 1. So this is the dispersive shift in cavity QED. The challenge for us is that if you'd like to actually be in this weak measurement regime, we need to put of order 1 n bar of 1 photon in that cavity and read it out with very good efficiency. So that's a little bit difficult in the microwave. Okay. Just to show you that we can do that, here's a qubit driven to either 0 or pi, followed by a readout pulse. If I put a very energetic 35-photon pulse into the cavity, then there is no problem separating out 0 and 1. And from the point of view of quantum state readout and quantum computing, you can use more photons and really pull them apart as much as you like. But here, in fact, we're going in the opposite regime of decreasing the n bar. And when I'm down to about 2 photons, you can see I start to get significant overlap of my histograms without a deleterious increase in the width. So the noise, in fact, is very good in this system. We estimate we're only 2x off the noise, quantum noise floor in this experiment. So does it work? Well, I can drive a qubit and now try to continuously read it out. Okay. If I read it out with a very small number of photons, the decay that I see is mostly due to dephasing from the environment. So this is the case where my little inspector does not have a very good set of magnifying glasses. Just looking very weakly at the qubit, it happily decays because it's talking to all the other defects in the environment. If I go ahead and increase now the number of photons all the way to 2 photons, you can see, in fact, the decay is enhanced. And this decoherence, this relaxation, this decoherence dephasing is really caused by my measurement, right? An interaction with the measurement apparatus. It's not caused by defects in the environment. Yeah. So the question is, can I correct for that? Well, we use perhaps a very simple feedback loop here, which is well known in all of classical engineering as the phase lock loop. Okay, I have a clock, which is bad, as John mentioned. A qubit sometimes is a bad clock. In particular, if you measure it, it's a really bad clock at the same time because it has measurement-induced dephasing. So how do you correct a bad clock? Well, you check it versus a 10-cent clock, which is very good, which is a quartz oscillator. Right? This one is what, $1 million? This one is 10 cents. Okay? So you beat the two together, and you look at the error signal which comes out. If the qubit is trailing my reference oscillator, I have a knob I can turn to make it oscillate faster, which is the amplitude of my Robbie drive. Right? If I pump it harder, it Robbie flops faster. If I pump it weaker, it Robbie flops slower. So I can adjust in real time the amplitude that I drive my oscillator with and correct for this. In fact, that's what one does in a phase lock loop. So does it work? So here's with no feedback. This is the ensemble average decay. If I turn on the feedback, you can see the oscillations are stabilized. And in fact, this plot goes out to 40 microseconds. You can go out to as long as you like. It's an analog feedback experiment, so it stays happily locked. You can also look in the spectral domain, which actually gives a lot of information. This blue curve is really the Fourier transform of this quantum oscillation. Okay. I have a qubit, it's oscillating. I can imagine taking its Fourier transform. The width gamma, you see, is related to the number of photons I probe it with. If I probe it very strongly, it becomes an extremely broad oscillation. I can also take that to the Zeno regime if I wish, but not shown here. And in the case of n bar of 0, where I don't put any photons in the cavity, this remnant rate here tells me what I have due to my environment. Okay. So this remnant measurement rate here is much smaller than the gamma in the experiment. And that's really the regime we wanted to be in for feedback. In particular, now if I turn on the feedback pulse, you see I have a nice delta function, showing me that I've, in fact, really made the line width of my oscillator extremely narrow. Okay. Now, if we really believe in this, then we can do the following experiment, which is to start the Robbie oscillations. I'm extracting information, but on purpose, I don't close the feedback loop. So if I don't close the feedback loop for some particular time, it decays. But maybe later, we decide to go ahead and close the feedback loop. If nothing is really lost in quantum mechanics, the only thing that we've lost is the information of the phase. We can get it back at some later time. And in reality, you can turn it back on at some later time and get the qubit oscillating again as you wish. And if you really think that this is still something classical, as we always do as experimentalists, we can perform tomography at some later state and really show you that the block vector is oscillating around as it should. Okay. So in the final 2 minutes, I wanted to just show you a slide of how we're now trying to take all of these different tools and try to do the experiment which I sort of alluded to at the beginning, was how to entangle two objects which are remote. So this proposal, I'd like to acknowledge Joe Kirchhoff and Yamabuchi. This is something we looked at for some time. So we affectionately call this the bounce-bounce setup, right, where you have two qubits, two transmon qubits in two different cavities, but in fact, we couple them here with the coaxial cable. So the idea is as follows. If I go ahead and I put a pulse, a microwave pulse, to one of the cavities, gain some information about this qubit, and then I let it propagate to the other cavity, it gains some information about that qubit, and then I let it come out of the system, and I amplify it. So in that way, if I adjust the measurement basis, I can, in fact, entangle those two qubits. And here's what I mean by this. Here's the input state along I. After the first qubit, I have a projective measurement now, right, where I pull apart 0 and 1. And if I adjust all the phases correctly, then I'm going to set it up so that 0, 1, and 1, 0, in fact, are indistinguishable by my measurement. Okay? So in fact, they will have the same phase shift along the I quadrature coming out of this apparatus, so that 0, 1, 1, 0 will be entangled. And if I make a measurement, here's some preliminary data here. Here's the histogram in light blue corresponding to the 1, 1 state. In dark blue is the 0, 0 state. 0, 1, and 1, 0 are the red and the green. And you can see they are rather indistinguishable in this measurement. So in fact, if I consider this part here and generate the probability of entanglement, after interaction of 300 nanoseconds, I start to see some interesting components in the density matrix build up for the entangled subspace. If I wait even longer, it looks like we are really able to go ahead and entangle these two states. Okay, so this is something in progress. And in fact, it may even get better if we squeeze vacuum in other places and so on and so forth. Okay, but just to give you an idea that this is something that we're moving towards. So I think my time is up. So I would like to say for future directions, we want to optimize the efficiency. At the moment, we are still suffering from inefficiencies due to physical losses in the system. Right? Our amplifier, we believe, is really quantum limited, but there is a wire which connects the amplifier to the qubit and so on and so forth. And that's a hard efficiency to fix, but we want to do that. Moreover, we'd like to think about how to read out multiple qubits together, in particular with this idea of entangling. finally, to get rid of many of those lossy components, it is perhaps possible to also take some of these parametric amplifiers and integrate them directly on chip with your qubits. Okay, so these are some of the directions we're looking at, and here are the folks that have actually done the hard work. Okay, thank you.
So we have time for a few questions. I have a question. So when you were rephasing the qubit, was the phase of the rephased qubit locked to the initial phase of the qubit?
No.
So it's slaved to
the clock.
Comparator. Okay.
That's right. That would be too many variables to know.
So I'm interested in making very high fidelity states and making them as quickly as possible. So you know, my natural thing is, well, I want to make a state. Do I let it decay to the ground state and then do some pulse to get it up to it? Or do I do kind of some of the things you're talking about? Okay. So I wanted to, what's your view of, with that in mind, I know that's a specific question. How do you make high fidelity states very quickly? How would you kind of compare this measurement-based scheme?
Good. There is a good set of papers and recent experiments by Leo DiCarlo, for example, at Dell. And the idea is, if you want to know with highest accuracy your state, you do a strong measurement, you figure out what it is, and then you park it wherever you want to put it. So for example, what Leo has done is he heralds, so to speak, the ground state. You measure the qubit as quickly as possible, you determine as much information as you can. If you measure it in the zero state, then fine. You go on and continue with your computation. If it's in the one state, you put the pi pulse in 2 nanoseconds and you put it into the zero state. So that's what Leo is doing to get very rapid initialization of the state and high state purity. Okay. So that, I would use strong measurement in that particular case. Right? Because here you want to actually project the state as rapidly as possible. Here on purpose, we're slowing it down so we can do something else with the state.
Mike has a question. I just wanted to see if I understood something, and sorry if I missed it. When you were discussing the cooling of the qubit to a particular state, so you started out with some thermal population and you said you cooled it. Is that, should I think about that like optical pumping, that you have a continuous driving field that's always on and it's always scattering photons and you end up in a particular state?
Yes. In fact, there are analogs to this in many fields of physics. That's one of them. You can think about when we did mechanical resonators in the old days, there was dynamical back action cooling, sort of similar concept. Sideband cooling, laser cooling, all of these things, they have different rates for these processes. All of them are on where you have a driving field, you leave it on, and the system goes someplace. The rates are calculated in slightly different fashion. This is a resonant process. However, like I said, if you move off the pole, it's exactly the same as sideband normal cooling.
Okay, here's another question.
Are there qubit states that you can cool to using the sideband cooling type method other than ground state or plus or minus states?
Yes, you can cool to any state on the block sphere for a single qubit. What we're really trying to do, although I think our competitors may beat us out on this, friends slash competitors, is to put 2 qubits, right, and cool to an entangled state.
You've shown that you can cool to a particular state. I'm wondering if you can take it further and cool to a particular unitary transformation.
I heard the answer. There was a yes in the back.
Not exactly. What I mean is you've shown that you can drive to a particular point on the block sphere, but engineering a unitary transformation is something more general. You're not going to a point. You're going to a transformation, which may move you around on the block sphere.
There are several proposals to do more complicated things, so we'd be very interested in any input on that.
Just a comment in response to Daniel. I think that here there is an important fact that if you can stabilize the state, you can actually steer any input state to a desired target. So it's a slightly different task from a control point of view. I'll also like to ask, what do you think about the prospect of having like two competing, one dissipate,
two competing.
Mm-hmm. Kinds of dynamical mechanisms, two kinds of dissipations, or a Hamiltonian and a dissipation, so that maybe you can also play in the stabilized state and see interesting features coming out.
Sure, we would be very interested in that.
Okay.
And I think then we're like biologists, where there's all sorts of dynamical processes which are competing with each other.
Okay, well, if there's no more questions, let's thank Irfan for a very clear talk.